loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now, they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.
RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
It's time for our political panel here on RCR Friday morning. Always look forward to this one. And joining us on the panel this morning, Claire Bleakley, GE Free NZ. Hi, Claire.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. And we've got you on because, well, we'll find out in just a moment why. Glenn Inwood, welcome back.
Hello, Paul. How are you doing? How's Arrow Town?
Not too bad, thanks. Oh, you've zoned me in. They'll come looking for me now.
Yeah.
Actually, I bowled a rabbit on the road.
Good.
Which is not hard to do because they're everywhere.
I'm surprised they wasn't frozen to death.
Well, it was sitting in the middle of the road, the dumb thing.
Did you eat it?
Yeah, did you pick it up?
Maybe if monkeypox comes in and we're all locked down and I need a quick feed, maybe. Marty Gibson. Hi, Marty.
Paul, how are you doing?
Not too bad, thanks. It's been a busy week at RCR. Great to have you folks on this morning. Okay, where to start? And I thought, Claire, seems it's your first time on our political panel, that you can kick off. And I'm wondering if you have anything to say about Judith Collins.
Well, I'd like to say the interview you gave with her really showed that she was uninformed. She's obviously been misled by her information. It appears that her information has relied solely on embedded GE patented people. They have not really looked into the community and farmers and the impacts of what GMO, if the ban comes off, is released. So to take some of the little things she mentioned to you, she mentioned there'd be a select committee. Well, if you release the ban, as she's telling the world, how can a select committee put in any further things to say stop? She's already made up her mind. And so yet again, as we are a democracy radio, she has removed the democratic right of around about 98% of New Zealand people.
Yeah. She seemed pretty confident in what she was saying. She kind of blew me off.
Oh, yes. It was a fait accompli. She's done it. But you then mentioned that had she seen some of New Zealand's research, e.g. the GM animals, she virtually said that was a conspiracy theory. Now, the document that you mentioned, GE Animals 15 Years in New Zealand, was actually taken directly from the annual reports required by our regulator on the health of the animals. And the fact that she hasn't even taken time to read that or not be aware of it shows the danger that New Zealand poses in going head on into the GMO issue.
Yeah. This should be something that the people of New Zealand, like, vote on?
Yes, absolutely. The other thing, too, is the GE ryegrass is incredibly bad performer. Over 25 degrees, it will die. It does not perform any better than the high-class elite cultivars we have today. And it will, if you look at the wind we have today, I don't know if you've got any wind down there, but our wind is almost blowing our roof off. GE ryegrass flowers 6 times a year. That pollen is going to go across the lake. It's not going to stay in one place. So I'm not quite sure how the regulator is going to ensure that GE pollen is not going to contaminate neighbouring fields.
What about apple? What about apple trees that grow in a year and bear fruit?
I'm highly, highly concerned on that one. And the reason I believe is technically an apple needs to mature before it flowers, just like a human, just like anything else. So we are really, if we extrapolate to a human body, we are saying that a child of eight, if given the right hormones, will be able to have a baby. It would most likely kill her, kill the baby, or stunt her for life. So what we are actually allowing is giving a tree a limited lifetime. So instead of lasting in the field 15 years of fruit production, it may only last three. So what happens? You have to replant. It may give you apples straight away, but in the end, you are paying patent for those apples. You will pay a copyright on those apples. You will not be able to use any seed. If the pollen contaminates non-GM orchards, how will that affect that progeny? I mean, we are looking at such incredible ignorance that she has shown in this. Let's lift the ban, let's exempt GMOs. Not one GMO that's been gene edited, am I aware of, has actually been tested for safety to the environment or to human health.
Okay. Do any of you guys really believe that an apple tree can grow in a year to bearing fruit? Really?
Well, if you I don't know, if you graft, if you've got grafts that you put on, it may be that they can. She was very offhand when you asked her, you know, who's been driving this. She said, "Oh, Imbi." I was like, "Yeah, well,
yeah.
If you look at those problems you're talking about in terms of some of those horror stories that came out of the US and Canada with farmers having contamination of their grains by neighboring Monsanto fields and then Monsanto suing them. I mean, I'd be interested to know what role Monsanto played in the urgency around this. It amazes me the extent to which, I think it was a conversation you had, Paul, with Guy Hatchard, when he talked about the genetically modified microbial rennet, which is that enzyme used in the production of cheese, and how we're all eating cheese from GE.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that. Yep.
Yeah, already. I think about that every time I eat cheese, which is, you know, I quite like cheese. Virtually all cheese contains it. And so there's a lot of, been a lot of creep already. It's that tinkering with an incredibly complex system. And that was another point that Guy Hatchard made. I think it was at the NZDSOS conference that you emceed. He said, you know, people sort of think of these processes within the cell as a linear thing, but there's this absolutely incredible synchronicity of things happening all at once. It's a system that we barely understand. So, I always think a precautionary principle is wise.
Glenn, they did the launch in a lab wearing two sparkling white, new, never-worn-before lab coats, Judith Collins and Christopher Luxon. They look like dicks, really.
Look, there's no doubt that this is an extremely serious issue, and as Claire raises, you know, there are more questions than answers there. You know, the interesting thing is that overseas, in places like Italy, that have a food dietary culture, they're banning GMO. They're not wanting to put that into the food system. And as a very good friend of mine here in Wellington always points out, once it's released, it's out there. And you can't put the genie back in the bottle. So we need to make very sure that what we are doing is exploring all of the angles on this and that it's the right thing. But the select committee, look, if this government is going to rush this through, push this through, the select committee, Claire is right, will have very little change in that. So, or unless there are some very strong submissions and presentations to it. But ultimately, it is something that is every New Zealander needs to look at. You know, Italy won't put it in their pizza or in their pasta or what makes Italy great. You know, the same with Japan.
Make Italy great again.
There's quite a pattern though of these select committees being formed and then signals that really they're just window dressing. I mean, the Reserve Bank you know, were getting submissions on digital currency and then announced that they wanted to have one by 2030. It's like, well, you know, have you sort of already made up your mind? What's the point in submissions?
Yeah. I understand the juggernaut of digitalization that has been going on. But, you know, these are very serious things that involve every New Zealander, and we should be having far better representation by the entire population on these matters rather than just a few people who attend a select committee.
My problem is the top layers of federated farmers are all pro-GMO. One of the person who was life sciences leader was William Rolleston. He was also integral in trying to influence the Royal Commission to drop our GMO status. And he was one of the lead people in putting this stuff together. So we as the consumer, the farmer, whatever, really have got little say. And my biggest concern is this new bill is going to move itself from environmental protection and livelihood protection to business and innovation. And so all you have to do is make a business case on a supposition that this might work for it to get approved, rather than the environment and what we're looking at.
I also mentioned in that chat mRNA, because there's an example of the genie out of the bottle already, and no one, no agency stopped that. So we've already had an example of that. I mentioned to her it was a disaster, but there is an in-your-face example of the genie out of the bottle.
For me, you imagine what we felt like with those people who were getting adverse effects from being vaccinated, right? That's what a plant would be going through. It's just that we can't relate to the animal or the plant. No. All that stuff is happening at that level in a plant. What happens when we ingest those mutations, whatever? We have no idea. We should be looking at what the next generation and the health of that should be happening.
Yep.
And to me, we are actually causing a collapse of the food system, and then it becomes a dependence on the industry, the bio industry. What will happen is if we don't buy into it, they might then say, well, we won't send you any grain or whatever until you do what we want.
Yeah, held to ransom. Yeah.
Yeah. And the last national government actually said our main aim is to have a free trade deal with America. What Assange came down with is he found a piece of paper that said, we'll consider that if you drop your GE laws.
Yep.
So this is just that. So we know that we are being led by the nose with big industry and international industry.
I think that's a good pivot to Ukraine. Because Glenn, I've been thinking about BRICS lately, and maybe we should think about joining it. Is that crazy?
I don't know if it's crazy, Paul. I just don't know if it'll happen. I don't think it'll happen. We're more pivoting back towards the US, you know?
Yeah, but they're not a great trading partner, are they?
Well, we don't have a free trade agreement. We've never had one, but I don't know where that will go in the end. We seem to be cozying up to them a lot closer. And I know I go on about it, and I know, I must say, there's probably a danger that I read too much of what's going on into the war in Ukraine, and that comes with the territory. But this is, you know, not just a minor skirmish. And the only reason I bring it up often, Paul, is that it's a full-scale war that is having an enormous impact on global politics, right? Anyway, in any conflict, it always takes a lot of work to find out exactly what the reality is. And this one is no different. It's never easy separating the wheat from the chaff, especially when you're getting such a skewed perspective from Western media. And whether it's US media, UK media, or our own media, if I only ever got my information from New Zealand mainstream media, then I'd be completely in the dark, except for anything that happened in the latest episode of Married at First Sight.
Yeah, or so casketeers.
It really is an appalling situation. And in order to get any clear understanding of the situation, particularly on the Ukraine battlefront, it's necessary to look way beyond Western media to blogs, to podcasts, to the various Telegram channels, the various accounts on X, and then a clearer picture does begin to emerge. And that's why I thought, well, look, we should discuss this current Kursk situation, because it does seem to me that, if you did believe the Western media headlines, you'd be led to believe that this is the new, or could be the new, Ukrainian counteroffensive that is underway, and it's making massive gains in Australia, and into Russia. And I have absolutely no doubt that there is fierce fighting going on in the area, but you have to ask, to what end, right? What is this all about? Because it seems like this is nothing but a PR exercise on behalf of the Kiev regime. It has taken troops away from other areas of fighting, like in the Donbass, to bolster the attack that they're doing in the Kursk area, ultimately to gain control of the Kursk nuclear power station. And it may have taken Russia by surprise, or it may not have. There is discussion that Russia knew this was happening anyway and has set up traps for them. And it's not like Ukraine is able to replace the troops that it has lost. You know, in July, it's been reported to have lost around 50,000 soldiers. And in the first week of August, apparently around another 13,000 Ukrainian soldiers have been lost, dead or wounded. But it's not like they have an endless stream of soldiers to take their place. They just aren't there. Even the numbers of foreign mercenaries has dwindled. So what I'm getting to is that it appears, in my view, that this could be highly reminiscent of the Battle of the Bulge in December 1944, when the Nazis made a last-ditch attempt to break through the Allies' advance. But they couldn't, and within months, they were pushed back into Germany and their ultimate surrender. So given even Ukrainian telegram channels like Legitimi and others alluding to the fact that why is Kiev risking more soldiers when they can least afford it? Are we just going to witness the rapid demise of the Ukrainian military from this point onwards? Because this attack does appear, as a lot of commentaries are stating, that it's a road to nowhere. It's a dead-end strategy, and it has no operational significance.
They're going to get wiped out, Glenn. They're going to get wiped out.
German media, which has been very pro-Ukraine, even doubts this offensive. Der Spiegel headlining that this maneuver could mark the end of the Ukraine military. So perhaps what I think, if anything good can come of this, is that we may see an end to the Ukraine war sooner rather than later. If this is Zelensky looking for to gain some advantage to bring Russia to the negotiating table, I would imagine he's horribly mistaken.
Yeah, I agree.
And I feel that Russia is more looking at possibly trying to find who can replace Zelensky and the upper echelon there in the Kiev regime. Who knows? But also, it must be breathing down Zelensky's it must be in his sights now. Is you're only less than 100 days away from a US election, and the possibility of Trump winning could see an end to US spending on the war, and that would further exacerbate hasten, the Ukraine military's collapse. So it's all going to be very interesting in this, and perhaps we're not far away from it ending, which would be a wonderful thing in the world. It really would.
It didn't need to happen, and over 500,000 dead. So sad.
Well, 500,000 Ukrainians. And yeah. It would imagine Luxon saying, we're going to fight to the last New Zealander. You'd think, no.
Bugger off.
That doesn't sound like a good idea at all. But you're right about the other sources of information, Glenn. I've watched the discussion between Jeffrey Sachs, who's the American economist and public policy analyst, who's a professor at Columbia University. He had a chat with Tucker Carlson and just laid out the 170-year arc of this conflict. It started with Lord Palmerston working out that if they pinched Russia off from having a Mediterranean port, they wouldn't be a threat. It would sort of shrivel them as a country. And then Zbigniew Brzezinski, the US strategist, essentially wrote, took a leaf out of Ardern's book and said, let's do this, and basically said that's the policy for us. And if you look at he spelled it out in the early 90s. He said, well, let's get the Eastern European countries in NATO in the 1990s, and then in the 2000s we'll get the Baltic countries, and in 2010 we'll get Ukraine in. And that's why they bombed Kosovo for 78 days. They wanted a NATO base there. So there's all of these things. If you ask someone what was the war about in Serbia, it was because they were being mean to Muslims. No, it wasn't. And yeah, if you go around with these ideas in your head that the CIA wants you to have, it's very hard to make sense of anything.
Exactly, and you're making a very good point there, Marty, because there are some very smart people who are discussing these issues, and the Jeffrey Sachs interview with Tucker Carlson was extremely illuminating. And you have other very smart people like John Mearsheimer from Chicago, who has given and warned Ukraine back in 2014, 2015, that this will lead to their destruction. And it was ignored, advice that was ignored. And you've got Scott Ritter, who is getting raided. His house is being raided by the FBI.
Yeah, saw that.
What he's saying. So there are some very smart people here who are pushing back against the American narrative of this. And people, they're people who just aren't being listened to inside those circles. And then you have what's happened in Bangladesh. There's a lot of chatter about the Bangladesh being orchestrated by the US. Look, I have no idea. I don't know. But these things, they lead to some very interesting discussions around these matters.
Do we have anything to say about New Zealand taking a side in this with Ukraine and putting in over 100 million?
It just shows the extent we're beholden to the blob. Sorry, Claire.
Oh, no. This analogy that we're talking about, when you actually look at who the puppeteer is, it's the US all the time. You look at what's happening in Gaza, in Palestine. I mean, you turn on the news every day. I listen to Al Jazeera, and 180,000 women and children have either not been accounted for or have been killed. We talk about 37, but the UNICEF came out with 180,000 the other day. So what we see is you can see that Russia is actually the baddie. And what we're trying to, what the US is trying to do is totally and utterly destroy it. Because if they were at all balanced in their viewpoints, they would be not supporting with billions and billions of dollars the Israeli destruction of the Middle East. And it's going further and further, because we know that the axis of evil were three countries, Iran, Russia, and North Korea. And you look at where the Israeli war is going, and it's going straight back to Iran now. And so, once we've got Ukraine out, the problem is Russia, America, I think, is so it's too torn it's got two things going and it can't support both. And so both are going to fail eventually. And America, hopefully, will go down with it. And we're talking about the American government. We're not talking about the people. We're talking about the CIA government.
All right, let's move on. Marty, the dumbest climate conversation of all time, experts on the Musk-Trump interview. It apparently broke the internet.
Yeah, it was good to listen to, just in terms of people speaking freely in a way that contradicted the prevailing wisdom that's the only thing that we're allowed to hear on mainstream media. So it was interesting to see The Guardian reacting to that, and they were quite thrown off balance by it. It said Trump and Musk's discussion on the climate crisis spelunked down into entirely new levels of stupidity, according to Bill McKibben, a veteran climate activist and co-founder of 350.org. So no surprises there. They trot out these things that are accepted wisdom, like the damaging effects of climate change in terms of more extreme weather events. The data indicates that there are a lot fewer extreme weather events now than there were 100 years ago. There's 99% reduction in per capita climate-related deaths than there were 100 years ago. And they talk about the damage to nature. And, I mean, area around deserts have greened up by 15%. The Earth's greened by 15%. So, it's interesting to have that on the table. And I am always interested in the anti-human angle of climate change and its origin. When you talk about the U.S. government, I mean, I think about the people who print the money who are based there. I mean, you could destroy the U.S. government. The people who are pulling the strings aren't particularly American.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know, the Committee of 300 aren't exclusively American. So, yeah, it's interesting seeing that play out. And, I mean, the thing with the Ukraine, again, if Trump is up against the CIA, have been working to start that war, it's not him against Zelensky.
Mm, absolutely. I'd like to, something that came out in that Guardian article was something that Trump did mention, was the nuclear effect of climate change. I can't remember his exact word. But just in our little area in the Oceania, Fukushima is still leaking radioactive water into the Pacific.
It's not leaking, Claire. It's been deliberately put in. But
there is leaking, but they have contained it. They are now putting 300,000 litres of heated water that's taken around about 7 years to get to a temperature they reckon will not be detrimental to the ocean if they drop it in here. But it's, of course, still got radioisotopes in it. And stuff like that. And
no, it only has tritium in it, which you can't remove.
That's right. But that's a highly heating substance. And we look at how oceans work, and in no time at all, that heat can be distributed. So when we talk about the oceans warming, we must factor in factors like Fukushima. And that kind of
that would make no difference to the ocean, Claire.
I reckon it would.
The oceans are just so vast.
Mm. No. It has more sense than talking about carbon dioxide getting
stored. Look, I'm going to have to disagree with you there, Claire. All of the radiation has been taken out of that of the water through a process called Alps treated. Water. It only contains tritium, and even the New Zealand scientists who are part of the IAEA and very experienced in this all admit that it'll have little effect. It'll be diluted very quickly into the Pacific, And Japan has set up a lot of monitoring systems all throughout the Pacific to test it and keep an eye on it, as well as they have done their very best, I think, under a very trying circumstance when the tsunami took out Fukushima power station. Japan has 28 nuclear power stations. It shut them all down and put them through a very rigorous process of determining their structural safety. And even then, some of them are still going through that process. It's a long process. But I would, I think Japan has done all it can, and it has no room anymore to hold that water. It has removed all the radiation. Only tritium is in there, and it will be diluted very quickly.
That was impressive, Glenn.
Thank you.
How do you know all this?
Look, it's something that I'm involved in and take an interest in, Paul.
Okay, let's stay with you, Glenn. The UK and EU clamping down on X and free speech. Two-tier Kia has been talking about an increase in facial recognition around the country, and all the clips going around, pressure on Elon Musk, the chilling effect.
Well, it leads into, Paul, what Marty was saying, but, you know, there was this letter released by the European Union's Commissioner for Internal Market, a guy called Thierry Breton, and who wrote to Elon Musk ahead of the discussion that Musk was going to have with Donald Trump, and essentially warning him, reminding him of the due diligence obligations that are set out in the EU's Digital Services Act and X's obligations to comply with that act in the EU. Now, the EU is already taking legal action against X, and it's a warning that he's obligated to restrict, that Musk is obligated to restrict illegal or wrong information from being distributed via his platform. You know, it's like they think X is responsible for things like the UK riots or people turning against the EU. You know, this is, it's clear the EU doesn't like X. It thinks it's a platform for disseminating misinformation. And one suspects that the EU commissioners blame X for a lot of stuff, and they just want to suppress its ability in the EU. The letter implies that that Musk talking to Trump alone is misinformation. At least that's the inference that can only be drawn from this. It was a very bizarre letter. I thought it was a joke, but apparently it's not.
Well, they can't control X. They can control everything else, but they can't really control X.
Yeah, I don't think they're worried about misinformation. They're worried about information.
Real information.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and you know, you've got the mainstream media saying, well, a lot of this problems with these riots are actually can be sheeted back to the Tories, because they created a lot of disaffected people with their industrial policies in places like Rotherham. And I'm like, yeah, I'm pretty sure it was the gangs of migrants going around raping underage children. And the fact that the police ignored it.
I'm pretty sure
it's that more than unemployment.
The EU has a charter on fundamental rights that protects freedom of expression, Article 11. And the very fact that X also is an American company based in America, currently in San Francisco, but moving very soon to Texas for perfectly legitimate reasons and well-publicized reasons, all suggests, you know, Elon Musk will ignore this letter. And I even saw an X post from him essentially saying, bring it on. Now, why...
What he actually said was, take a big step back and literally F your own face. It was even stronger than bring it on, Glenn.
I bring this up because I don't believe it's going to be too long before we see similar action being taken here in New Zealand and to some degree We are already seeing the clampdown on freedom of speech. We have the New Zealand police visiting people through what they say on social media. This was even occurred even as recently as last week, when a particular account on X saw a couple of cops turn up to his house. Now, I've seen the video on that and the discussion on it around on X itself and other social media channels. So we're not that far. We have the New Zealand police having their training manuals to discuss what is hate speech. And yep. By my mind, I think this is already dealt with in the Crimes Act. It's already dealt with in other legislation where you threaten somebody, then you deserve to be talked to and you know dealt with by the authorities. But a lot of what we are seeing is not violence. It's not intending to cause violence or encourage people to take violent actions. They are just merely expressions of opinion.
Yeah,
that is a very slippery slope. It's the thin end of the wedge.
Are we ready for the monkeypox? Sorry, mpox. Because this will be a factor, won't it? And who says what?
Kind of disappeared when they found out that homosexual men were spreading it to children and dogs. It sort of faded out after that.
Just going back to what Glenn and Marty brought up about the Theory Gibson letter. Firstly, what we need to know is what is misinformation. But it looks like they're wanting to shut X down because that kind of alternative viewpoint, if they do roll out the this latest pandemic in the next few years, they really don't want somewhere like X to be able to put up those types of views. So I would like anybody, can you tell me what they mean by misinformation or illegal stuff? I mean, as Glenn was saying, you know, we're governed by our laws and all those hate speech laws and all that which have been introduced the last few years will protect us. And X doesn't seem to have crossed those boundaries. So what is it that is misinformation?
Well, there's a whole academic department formed in Harvard about misinformation, and that's where Jacinda Ardern's gone. And it's a multidisciplinary approach which involves the pharmaceutical industry, as I said, the three-letter agencies, and it's anything that contravenes the interests of the blob. Mike Benz is fascinating on this. And there's AI at play picking up anything that is contrary to those interests. So I think, you know, it's a jackboot stepping on a human face forever.
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
That's nice. All right. New Zealand opts out of joint standard on infant formula. Claire, what do you want to say about this?
Well, Food Standards Australia, New Zealand, what we call FSANS, is a trans-Tasman regulator for the GE foods and stuff like that that come into New Zealand. And the latest thing that they put forward was a labelling issue. And there is a real irony in it. They were saying that they were trying to limit what you could say on your label due to the fact that they wanted to promote breastfeeding. Now, Andrew Hoggard has actually, he's the Minister for Biosecurity and Food Safety, and he has said as long as infant formula is safe and the claims on labels are not misleading, consumers should be allowed to make their own informed choices. Now, that's fantastic, but FSANS last week gazetted a milk protein made through GMOs, and it is the fifth milk protein made to produce this mimic of human breast milk. There's another one in the pipeline that we have to make a comment on. And none of these products in infant formula are labeled. And so I find this dichotomy, even though I'm really pleased that we have withdrawn and we're going to create our own labeling regime, what we need to do is label the GMOs that are insidiously coming into our diet. And Marty, you mentioned that in the cheese example. That's not labeled. The other thing too is FSSAN says additives aren't labeled. And there's a big submission out that they want to now change the definition of GMOs, and they're calling them products of new biotechnologies. And that is out now, and we are having to go through that. But in the end, all these products are trying to escape labeling. And as a consumer, we have a right, I believe, to know what we're feeding our infants. And if we need to avoid GMOs, we need to know if those infant formulas, which go up to 5 years old, and in fact, elderly people are also being given them.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh. You know, all those sort of milk formulas that you...
What, in rest homes? Places
yeah,
like that.
That kind of stuff. Yeah.
Okay. But get them off to sleep.
So what's happening is, FSSANS has said, if it's highly processed, it doesn't need to be labeled. And that is what you were mentioning, Marty. So for me, we've almost got it right. And we have to say we applaud Andrew Huggard for taking this out. But wouldn't it be great if when we do develop our law, we actually get GMO labelling.
All right, we're coming up against time, and Marty, big cuts, restructuring for the Ministry of Disabled People I have here, but they're not called that, are they?
No, it's
called that. Yeah.
Which means chasing strength, which is, you know, it's kind of quite a nice word.
Yeah, it works. Yep.
Yeah. It's being massively scaled back following the findings of an independent review. Now, this was from Newsroom initially. So there's a review led by Sir Martin Wevers that found the delivery of support services was inconsistent and hampered by the way FICAHA had been set up. And he said, recent events have revealed that the ministry was ill-prepared for its important role. Its establishment in the late stages of the COVID-19 pandemic was rushed, and challenges soon emerged in dealings with partner agencies that had been charged with providing shared services and other support. And he also found there was inadequate budgetary control and commercial rigor, and disability issues. Minister Louise Upston confirmed the overspend forecast for this current year was $150 million. So yeah, the student politicians didn't set it up very well. The thing that fascinates me about this is the bad. There are some people who really deserve government help, and I think most New Zealanders like to think their tax goes to supporting their, but for the grace of God, go I people.
Much rather that than Ukraine.
Yeah, and much rather both than climate. Not Ukraine so much. But yeah, no. So they're having problems with this. But it seems that again, they may have had some people who don't like the government working in the public sector who are putting a stick in the spokes.
Okay.
Have you guys looked at this at all? So they're saying they're committed to funding it, but they're going to wind it into
MSD.
Yeah, I didn't even realise there was a Ministry of Disabled.
So this is reducing the bureaucracy by at least one ministry.
Well, they're going to keep the ministry by the look of it.
Well, it's actually happening across the board. Creative spaces which support disability and isolated communities, their funding has almost disappeared. So the arts that those communities can do to for their wellness, and we've seen that, that funding's gone. My concern is we've got, is it $3 billion being given in tax cuts? Now, we've actually traded the tax cuts for the services that our taxes pay for. And I saw the other day that health was sort of on a life support, the health service. So really, are we cutting the cloth too short and we're actually destroying the social systems that we've set up for things like charter schools and private public partnerships?
Was that a rhetorical question, Claire? Yeah.
No, I was asking you, Claire, Marty, or you, or you, Claire.
The upward movement in the percentage of GDP that's the public sector needs to come down, I think. It's steadily grown. And what's ironic is that in their first budget, Grant Robertson and Ardern, I think, had it at about 28%. The new Minister for Finance is having it trending up towards 39%, I think, by 2035. It's just keeping growing, and they're going to have to cut some things. The problem that I have is that they sometimes cut things that most people think should receive funding. As I said, the people who have got really disabled kids.
I'm entirely in agreement there with you, Marty, that we do have to cut the bureaucracy, and there needs to be more vigilance over overreaching bureaucracies who keep wanting to bring more people on to do various work. And the government, the ministers themselves need to say, no, look, hold on. We don't need to do that. That can be dealt with some other way, private sector or whatever, but we don't need to keep growing the bureaucracy. And this is where we've got to after 6 years of Labour. Not only that, also because it also grew under Key as well, but I think really we need to take a very hard look at the bureaucracy and decide what is it that we want them to do and not to do, because they're taking a lot of work away from the private sector as well.
Any final comments to say about anything we've been talking about this morning?
Government big enough to do anything for you is big enough to take everything from you is a good way to look at it, I think.
Yeah.
And we saw intimations of that, certainly during COVID. You saw that in the, attitude of...
Where did that come from?
Yeah, it was always there.
You're lucky you were able to go out to do that. We were stuck at home, unable to go into or any cafes or libraries.
Yeah, they were lucky, yeah. I got to run down Queen Street in the middle of the road from the top to the bottom. No one was around, so.
Should have done it naked, Paul.
What's to say he didn't?
There were one or two people around. That would have come back to bite me over and over again if I'd done that.
You would have totally lost your voice.
Yeah. All right, so we're done with our political panel. Claire Bleakley, President of GE Free NZ, thank you for coming on this morning. Great to have you.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it, and I really enjoyed the discussion. So thank you. It was lovely to meet you all.
Marty Gibson, always good to have you.
Always a pleasure, Paul. Thanks very much.
And Glenn Inwood, thanks for coming back on the panel, Glenn. And I was so impressed with your knowledge of the Fukushima nuclear reactor. Wow.
My pleasure, Paul. At least thank God it's Friday and you've got the weekend to recover.
Loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it. And right now, they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.